I will tell you, today is February 4th, the last class in our 15-week semester on the book of Bereshit. We're not going to study today the last unit, which is unit 10. We're going to stay in unit 9, which is the Akedah. I thought it better to complete what we began. We can never really complete it, but to continue what we began, it's actually 3 weeks ago because we missed 2 weeks. So, we will not read now the text of the Akedah. We more or less remember about the story of Abraham being commanded to execute, to kill, to slaughter his son, and him doing what had to be done to prepare for that, making the journey, putting his son on the altar, raising his hand with the knife. To the last minute, he's told by an angel, a voice from heaven, that he should cease and desist. We saw a commentary of the Ramban, Nachmanides, from the Middle Ages, from the 13th century, in which he explicated the idea of test, because the verses that talk about Avram being commanded to sacrifice his son, those verses begin with the introduction that says that God tested Abraham. And the question that the Ramban asked was, what is the nature of a test? And what we basically saw in the Ramban is that a test is not for the administrator of the test. It's for that person who's being tested. God knows what the qualities of Abraham are. Doesn't have to figure them out through a test. Rather, the test is in order to ennoble the one being tested. It's to put the person in a difficult, challenging situation. And God only puts someone in situation, according to the Ramban, when God knows the person is capable of overcoming the stumbling block and meeting the challenge. And through meeting the challenge and through overcoming the stumbling block, the person is ennobled and the person is lifted up to a higher spiritual and moral level. The wording that the Ramban used was the actualization of potentiality. We have in ourselves certain potentials, of course, certain abilities that are latent, but only when we are given the opportunity under difficult situations, in difficult circumstances, to put those latent talents into practice, only then do they really become part of us in a real and a deep sense. And in that context, I talked also about the words of the Me'a Shiloach, the Hasidic author that we'll be learning for those who continue next semester, who mentions that the Talmud says that no one ever learns any words of Torah unless he first stumbles over them. And those words of the Talmud are applied by the Me'a Shiloach to life in general. There's nothing you ever learn. There's no learning that's ever done. There's no growing that's ever accomplished. There's no deepening of the personality, and there's no insights that are truly, truly absorbed to become part of you unless you struggle. Unless it was difficult, unless you first failed and had to pick yourself up by your bootstraps, only then do you become a better and deeper human being. Only then do you actualize your potential. And the Ramban, in that sense, is telling us, and he says this explicitly, the test was for Avram's benefit. And when Avram finished with the test, he probably felt himself to be an uplifted, a deeper, a greater human being. That was the Ramban. I'm reviewing that because I want to compare it to something else we learned last week and to learn something from the comparison. The other matter we saw last week, and by last week I mean the last class, we saw the interpretation of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik, who lived in our generation, passed away just 15 years ago. Rabbi Soloveitchik said things very different than the Ramban. Rabbi Soloveitchik only pointed out the difficulty, the sacrifice, the pain, and the loss involved in the Akedah. That when God said to sacrifice this child, God didn't promise you'll get another one in his place. God didn't promise it'll be easy. God didn't say it's good for you. It's going to be bad. It's going to be terrible. It's just about sacrifice in the simple meaning of the word. Avram was asked to sacrifice his son and to sacrifice his beliefs, to sacrifice his consciousness, to sacrifice his family life, to sacrifice everything he believed, to sacrifice his sanity. It was terrible and was meant to be terrible. It was meant to be terrible. And I mentioned that in the passage brought in our curriculum, Rabbi Soloveitchik doesn't explain why God commanded Avram to do a terrible thing, do something that's going to destroy his inner fabric and outer fabric. But in other places, in other writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik, there's an explanation of what Rabbi Soloveitchik thinks is going on here. And that's not in the curriculum. And I mentioned in particular an article that Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote about 40 years ago called Majesty and Humility. Majesty and Humility. And the title of that article describes what it's about. And it actually goes back to the first chapter and the second chapter of Genesis. That, as you remember, Kohen Rabbi Soloveitchik present two different modes of how to live your life. The first chapter of Genesis is majesty. Man is meant to be in God's image. Man is meant to be a creator. Man is meant to conquer the world, to improve the world, to continue where God left off. Man is majestic. Man is great. Man gets a lot of credit for being just like God and making the world a better place. Man is powerful, man is a molder, man is a builder, and that is all good. It's important. But in the second chapter of Genesis, it's about man is lonely. Man in an existential crisis. Man who's looking for companionship. Man is commanded by God and has to fulfill the commandments and fails and sins in the first chapter. In other words, what Rabbi Soloveitchik says is there are two modes of being a human being, and they're both necessary. The first mode is majesty. Be a creator. Be a doer. Be a changer of the world. But secondly, and that's majestic and it's great and it adds to man's stature, but you also have to have humility. You have to know your limitations. You have to be able to accept the yoke of heaven. You have to be willing to say, okay, when God says to do something, you have to accept commands, you have to accept your limited stature, you have to be able to retreat and recoil and surrender in the face of an inscrutable divine command. Rabbi Soloveitchik claims that it's the humility that purifies and sanctifies the majesty. That human majesty is important, but it can lead to arrogance, can lead to the breaking down of all boundaries when man thinks is the measure of all things. Majesty has to be limited by and tempered by, and therefore uplifted by, humility, by obedience, by the acceptance of the divine yoke. And the Akedah is the prime example of man being commanded to retreat and to give up, surrender what he believes in, what he knows to be proper. And that surrender has to be part of the human personality. That's what makes us deeply human. That's what sanctifies us. Because majesty without humility will run amok, will turn man into a inhuman creature. That's the way Rabbi Soloveitchik looks at it. The majesty has to be purified. So now, I want to think about the relationship between Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach and the approach of the Ramban. So I'll speak slowly. I think this is really important for, to me it's important for growth. They both claim, both thinkers claim, that ultimately the Akedah is good for Abraham, or good for those who learn from its lessons. But good in two different senses. According to the Ramban, the Akedah is good in the immediate experiential sense. So when I am tested with a difficult, trying situation, the Ramban, I think, is saying, I learn from that, I grow from that, and I know that I grow from it. I experience a certain catharsis and a certain growth after I overcome a difficult situation. It was hard, but when I'm finished with it, thank God, I grew from it. I learned something, and I experience that uplift and that reward. I experience that I've actualized another part of my personality. Rabbi Soloveitchik, on the other hand, claims that the Akedah was good for Abraham, but not in any type of sense that Abraham himself would have sensed. It's good to have your majesty purged, to have it tempered by humility, by failure, by surrender. But it's not that I feel good when I surrender. I feel that my goals and my hopes and my aspirations, my majesty was destroyed. It's ultimately good for man to be cut down to size. But not that I experience it as good, I experience it as bad. But in a priori metaphysical sense, Rabbi Soloveitchik claims we become better human beings through being forced to fail, through being forced to retreat, being forced to put aside some of our aspirations and hopes and plans and glorious visions. It cuts us down to size, and that's good for us. We don't like being cut down to size. It's not a good feeling. We experience it as bad. But Rabbi Soloveitchik claims it makes you a better person in a larger sense that you might not even understand. You might not experience. And as I was thinking about this, I thought that perhaps they're both true. They're both true, but it's like they're talking about two different sets of circumstances. The Ramban, I would say, and these are not words that he wrote, I'm now extrapolating, I'm telling you what I think. The Ramban seems to be talking about a trial that you successfully overcome. And Rabbi Soloveitchik is talking about a trial that breaks you, that you don't successfully overcome. The Ramban looks at the outcome of the Akedah, and Rabbi Soloveitchik looks at the process that occurred before the end of the Akedah. The Ramban looks at the end, everything turned out fine and well. Abraham proved himself, he was willing to sacrifice his son, he didn't have to do it, so that shows that for the Ramban, Abraham passed the test, and he became a better human being. He overcame the challenge, and that made him greater. But Rabbi Soloveitchik doesn't even look at the outcome in which Abraham was told by God, you don't have to do it. Rabbi Soloveitchik looks at the psychological process that went into it, the suffering, the pain of thinking you're going to have to kill your child, the pain at the moment of raising the knife. And Rabbi Soloveitchik almost says it's besides the point that in the end God said don't do it, but the pain was so terrible, and the suffering was so great, and the animosity created, the distance created between child and parent that can never be repaired. Avram was scarred, and Yitzhak was scarred for life. And that can't be changed. And you have to realize that that pain, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, is what God wanted. That pain somehow leads to, like we said, leads to a purging of the majesty, purging of the greatness of man, and that's necessary in the long run for man's ultimate development. But the Ramban and Rabbi Soloveitchik are looking at two different parts of the event. The Ramban's looking at the conclusion, the happy conclusion, and Rabbi Soloveitchik looking at the process. And I said to myself, so what does this mean for us? How does I apply this to my own life? And I was saying to myself that there are really two different scenarios here. And my wife is a cancer survivor, so I can talk about it in those terms. There's a case in which one is diagnosed with cancer and goes through a terrible, terrible, terrible process psychologically and physically, of self-doubt and psychological pain, and then there's the chemotherapy, and then there's the radiation treatment, and in the end, the cancer is vanquished. There are cases like that. And in some of these cases, I've heard it said that I grew so much from that, I learned so much from that, I became such a deeper, more sensitive, greater human being from that process, I would do it again. What people say is, I wouldn't have wanted to live my life without it. I've heard many cancer survivors say that. But you know what? That's not the only scenario. As we all know, there are people who die from cancer. You go through the pain, you go through the suffering, physical and mental, the chemotherapy, and the radiation treatment, and you know what? It doesn't work. And then you're in the hospice, and then death. You can't say in such a case, I would have gone through it again. A person lost his husband, lost his wife. They won't say, wow, I learned so much from that. I wouldn't have sacrificed that experience. God forbid. The person is gone. There's been a death. There's been a funeral. Both of those experiences, cancer that is overcome and cancer that is not overcome, both of those experiences are part of life. And I'd almost say that the Ramban is talking about cancer that is overcome. And Rabbi Soloveitchik is talking about cancer that is not overcome. The Ramban is talking about those experiences in our life of pain and suffering and trials and tribulations that are ultimately overcome, and they make us better people. Correct? And we experience ourselves as better people. We say, with all the pain, I wouldn't have wanted to live the life without that. It brought me to a whole new creativity, a whole new sensitivity, a whole new understanding of life. And that's what the Ramban is saying, and it's true. But there are other experiences in life in which it doesn't end up so nice. We lose a spouse, we lose a mother, we lose a child. And in those cases, you can't say that I wouldn't have wanted to live my life without that experience. I would have wanted to live my life without that experience. It was terrible, and it was terrible to the bitter end. But Rabbi Soloveitchik says that ultimately, humankind needs those experiences in order to temper, in order to limit, in order to circumscribe our tendency for greater and greater self-importance. Again, we should be majestic. We should believe in ourselves. We should accomplish in this world, the first chapter of Genesis. But that has to be tempered. Otherwise, it leads to all different types of terrible, terrible phenomena of conceit and arrogance on the individual level and on the societal level of totalitarianism and power run amok, etc. There are two different experiences I think we're talking about in life. And both commentators, therefore, I think we can see a real lesson in what they're saying on different levels.
I'd like to ask a question. Was the influence of Freud and Jung at all applicable to the writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik? He grew up and came on the scene during the times that these great people were telling us about the inner fears.
Of course, and he knew about it all.
And he had more to work with. He had all of the experience of reading the great masters and then living in the 19th and 20th century. Mm-hmm. Because I think when the Ramban was writing, no one knew what cancer really was. It was just, I mean, nobody lived very long at that time. The majority of the people died before they were 40. Isn't that correct?
There's a difference between the median age and the average age of death.
The average age, the
many people
age.
Lived longer.
Yeah.
But the lifespan was less because people died.
Much shorter. And I think to Rabbi Soloveitchik's credit, he was very modern. I mean, he read all the contemporary stuff, and he could he could understand the compassion just as you described. I don't think the Rambam could have talked about cancer the way you talked about it.
There are other diseases.
I know. I know. It's
okay. And by the way, add Kierkegaard to your list of possible influences.
Ah, okay.
Thank
you.
The last 2 weeks, I've sort of agonized over this whole lesson we're going through. I can't, in this day and age, there must be something else to this. I'm just not smart enough to know what it is, but somewhere free will comes into this. If you're a cancer victim, you have choices to make. You can go through radiation, chemo, all these things. So you have the free will to make these choices. But Isaac didn't have any free will about this. He's the child. And Abraham was the parent. And he certainly had the ability of free will and to think this thing through. Somewhere, I don't know, the message is totally, I don't agree with any of it. I can't even associate it. So here I am in the 21st century, and none of it is making any sense. And we just came out of a whole class of yours where life was so important. You had to have two people. You had to go to elders and everything else. If you had a wayward child, it wasn't necessarily that this was a wayward child. There's a complication. There's a half-brother that Abraham loved that he let out of the house with a surrogate wife. There's just more to this. I don't know what we're missing. Something here. There's just something totally missing.
I can only say one sentence. The emphasis, I can say two things. The focus, the emphasis, is not on Isaac. It's on Abraham. With all of the terrible, terrible, terrible injustice to Isaac, as far as we're concerned, as what we learn from this, he's not there. He's a foil. It's about Abraham. It's about Abraham's struggle. That's...
did he fail? He failed the test.
So according to the commentaries we've seen so far, and according to the simple reading of the text, Abraham passed the test. Are there other commentaries?
That's Sunday school stuff, that he passed the test.
That's what the Torah says. There are modern commentaries that say differently. Perhaps we'll have time to look at one or two of them. I personally don't see any way to reconcile those modern commentaries with the text of the Torah.
My struggle, and what I think the missing piece is, and I keep coming back to the same thing, is why you keep saying this is about Abraham. To me, I see this about Isaac and Isaac's future relationship with God. That God is telling Isaac, I'm going to be there for you. Abraham did what, I asked him to, and I saved you, and therefore my word is good. And I'm going to make a great nation out of your descendants. So to me, it's as much a lesson to Isaac in relationship to God as it is anything. And I think that's my missing piece. So I don't know, is that totally off?
That makes sense. I think it ignores the terrible, 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 terrible pain that Isaac was put through until he was saved. And that pain was also caused by God. But if we focus on the result, like you did, indeed, Isaac was saved by God, and the world was taught that God will never require human sacrifice. That's as far as the result goes. But again, Rabbi Soloveitchik is focusing not on the result, but on the process. Yeah.
Isaac had free will. Isaac was not a child, as we are seeing, and he made this choice. He willingly went every step of the way. He willingly laid down on the altar. I think that's what we all have tried. trouble with as well. Well, he was tied up. We don't know if he willingly went
there. Was he a young man?
His father was an older man. I don't like him so willingly. You could think that he would have.
Well, let's remember in the story, we don't know how old Isaac is. We know that he asks simple, naive questions of his father. Right? Where is the selola? Where is the sacrifice? His father says that God will provide it, and he seems to accept that answer. We don't know if he suspected at all what was going to happen as they were walking. We don't know that. But it does say that his father tied him up, and there's no indication of any fight there. Okay? The Torah, at the end of the story, doesn't mention Isaac. It mentions Abraham's greatness for passing the test. It doesn't say anything about him. So he doesn't seem to be the focus of the story. What we're supposed to think about his psychological state, we don't know. Yeah. Okay, let's see something else. Let's see in page 154 of our reader. This will go on for a number of pages, 154 to 55, 56. This is an author that I never heard of before. At the top of 154, Rabbi Bernard Och. Don't make the mistake that I made of thinking perhaps that this author is related to the female author we saw 3 weeks ago. Her name was Oaks, with an S at the end. What was her first name? I can't remember.
Oh, yeah.
From the University of Virginia, I think. Yeah. It'll come back to us. Vanessa. Vanessa. Anyway, so they're not related. This is Och, and that was Oaks. Here we go, the top of page 154. The Akedah belongs not only to Avram's life experience, but also relates to the entire history of mankind as portrayed in the biblical narrative. It is the climactic event in a chronicle which begins not with God's initial call to Abraham at Haran, but with his original design for humanity at creation. Avram's actions are to be explained not only by what is happening at the moment, nor by his previous history, but by all that has transpired since the very creation of the world and humanity. Thematically, the primeval period can be described as a progressive deterioration of the original unity and harmony of creation. Genesis 1 to 11 delineates two opposite and contradictory movements as divine creation is contrasted with human de-creation. Mankind's alienation from God is portrayed not as a one-time event, but as an ongoing process of disobedience and rebellion, characterized by man's constant refusal to accept his creaturely finiteness and his efforts to acquire an independence and power which go beyond the limits of human existence. This process of disintegration, with its disastrous consequences for mankind, is illustrated in a number of paradigmatic episodes which, together, constitute the period of primeval history that precedes the Abraham narrative: Eden, Cain, Flood, and Babel. These are the generations of mankind from Adam to Abraham, which have destroyed the original bond of creational harmony and have brought in its stead disunity and dispersion. This is the background for the appearance of Abraham as the one chosen by God to reverse the process of disintegration and to recreate a metaphorical Eden on earth, a place of unity and harmony between God and man. Step by step, episode by episode, the Abraham narrative provides a symbolic recapitulation of the events of primeval history. Abraham's journey from Haran to Mount Moriah is to be seen as a reverse reenactment of mankind's wandering from Eden to Babel. The history of humanity is now encapsulated in the life cycle of one man who has chosen to lead mankind back to God. History not only repeats but also reverses itself as Abraham, retracing the footsteps of his predecessors, moves out of the world of chaos and confusion back to the original harmony of creation. So a lot of nice words, right? And basically, in many, many words, he's just saying that the world was going into the dumps before Avraham's time. And Avraham, in a sense, retraces the steps of the world, and in his one personality, one lifetime, fixes, through his proper behavior, all the evils that were done and created by previous generations. He didn't yet tell us exactly the great things Avraham does. But we are to understand Avraham's life, not his life as an individual, but to look at everything in a broad perspective. His life is a tikkun, is a fixing, is a remedy to the evil that came before him. If the stock market before his time just went down, he's bringing it up again. And now he begins to explain. In the Garden of Eden, Adam's test is that of obedience to the word of God, as embodied in the prohibition concerning the tree of knowledge. Intentionally, God's command is neither explained nor elucidated, thereby placing the burden of acceptance or rejection entirely on the shoulders of Adam. It leaves no room for interpretation or application, only for obedience or disobedience. The unconditional command can only be listened to and obeyed if the recipient has complete trust and confidence in the God who commands. Eating from the tree of knowledge is the external expression of Adam's lack of faith in God and his unwillingness to submit himself unhesitatingly to divine authority. Within the context of the Abraham narrative, the Akedah event provides the test of the fulfillment counterpart to Adam's test failure experience in Eden. Similarly, faced with the command of extreme incomprehensibility, Abraham, in contrast to Adam, responds to the word of God with absolute obedience and trust. This is the force of Abraham's response, "Here I am," which precedes the command to sacrifice and thereby reverses the normal sequence of command response. Abraham, in other words, responds before he's even commanded. He says yes before God even said what. Abraham proclaims his complete readiness to obey prior to hearing the specific command. God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." He said, "Take your son, your only son." Where Adam rejected the word of God, Abraham responds with the entirety of his being in a relationship of total acceptance towards the presence of God. Through the eating of forbidden fruit, Adam has removed himself from God and broken the essential harmony of creation. Through the offering of Isaac, the fruit of his body, Abraham restores the original relationship of obedience to God. So, we'll think about that for a second. It's nice. But I think that it ignores a major element of the Akedah. In other words, if the Akedah was only meant to be a counterbalance to the eating of the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden, to make a tikkun, as it were, then Avram could have been commanded not to eat of a certain fruit, and he would have obeyed. There's so much more to the Akedah than obedience. It's about suffering and pain and a commandment that's not just incomprehensible, but it's immoral. It's not just don't eat of that fruit even though it looks so good. It's kill your son. And as I really think the author is trying to blind us, actually, he's trying to remove our gaze from the central issue of the Akedah, which he doesn't address at all. He doesn't talk at all about the terrible psychological suffering and the moral confusion that's involved here. For those things, we really have to go back to what we saw earlier, to the Ramban and to Rabbi Soloveitchik. To me, this is an example of how we try to we engage in apologetics. We write beautiful poetry and literature, but we can at the same time blind ourselves to the very real moral issues that all of us are dealing with. I didn't really get so much out of the commentary we just read. It's just an example of the efforts to make some sense of something that doesn't seem to have too much sense. Okay. Now we're going to see something that has a reflection in the Machzor, the High Holiday Prayer Book. I'm going to read something to you. And then we're going to go to the reader, to the curriculum. This is from the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, the additional prayers during the long morning service of Rosh Hashanah. It says as follows. You might be familiar with a different translation, of course. Our God and God of our fathers, remember us favorably and visit us with merciful deliverance from the eternal high heavens. Remember in our favor, Lord our God, the covenant, the kindness, and the solemn promise which thou didst make to our father Abraham on Mount Moriah, where the Akedah took place. Be mindful of the time when our father Abraham bound his son Isaac on the altar, suppressing his compassion that he might do thy will wholeheartedly. May thy mercy likewise hold back thy anger from us. Just like Abraham held back his compassion, so God, you hold back your anger from us in thy great goodness. May thy wrath turn away from thy people, thy city, thy land, thy heritage. I'm skipping a little bit. Thou who dost ever remember all forgotten things, for there is no forgetting before thy throne of glory, mayest thou on this day mercifully remember the binding of Isaac in favor of his descendants. In other words, do good to us in merit of the good that Avram did by fulfilling your command of being willing to sacrifice his son. That is a theme that appears again and again and again in Jewish literature, in the prayers again and again and again. God, have mercy upon us in zchut avot, right? The merit of the forefathers, zchut avot. Of all the different things that Avram did, of all the great things that Yitzhak did, of all the great things that Yaakov did, and Moshe, and all of our history, when we want to ask God, have mercy upon us, but not for our merits, because we don't have any, remember the merit of Abraham, that he was willing to stifle and hold back his love, his son, to do your commands. It's the greatest source of zchut avot. Just write on the board, zchut avot. Zchut is merit avot. Merit of the forefathers. And what we usually mean is a particular forefather and a particular act of the forefather, in other words, the Akedah. So we're going to see now one of the sources of this idea back in the early Midrashic literature. And it's in our folder on page 150. On page 150. And it says, Rabbi Bevai Abba said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. It's a reconstruction, as it were, of the Akedah, showing us the inner mindset of Avram, page 150, top of 150. Avram said before God, Master of the universe, Ribono Shel Olam, it is well known to you that at the time that you asked me to bring Yitzhak, my son, up to you, I had what to respond, and I could have said to you, yesterday you told me, quotas through Yitzhak, that you will gain posterity in Bereishit 21, and now you say to me, bring him up as an all burnt offering? Contradiction. But heaven forbid. By the way, is that a mistake? Is such a word, heaven forfend?
It's a mistake.
It's a mistake. Okay.
No, forfend is a legitimate word.
Forfend. There is such a word?
Yeah.
Yes, forfend, yeah.
Okay. Heaven forbid, that's what I'm going to say. Has v'shalom. I did not do that. I suppressed my natural feelings and I did your will. Well now, it should be your will, O God my Lord, that when the descendants of Yitzhak my son will be in trouble, without anyone to argue their case on their behalf, you should argue their case for them. God, I did you a big favor. I didn't protest. I didn't bring up the truth that you contradicted yourself. I just followed your will. I really, really suppressed my desire to explain to you, God, this is not the right thing to do. But I suppressed my will and all I did is comply. And you said, God, that I'd have great merit for doing that. So please protect my children, all future generations of Jewish posterity, because of this great act that I did. And this is the Midrash that really makes the Akedah the central focus of this idea of Zchut Avot, of the merit of the forefathers. And I want to talk about what it means. How could there be such an idea of Zchut Avot, of getting credit for something that you didn't do but someone else did? That's the idea.
The same with the sins. The sins of the father.
Right. It's the flip side of the coin when we see sometimes the sins of the fathers being visited on the children. Mm-hmm. And this is a concept in both directions, right? Leslie's side of the coin and the side of the coin here is something that we modern people have a lot of trouble with, justifiably so, legitimately so. I want to take a few minutes to try and explain how it's possible to understand this and to a certain degree accept the possible truth that's in it. The whole question goes back to the question of personal identity. That's who am I? Who am I? Now, on a very simple level, we all say, well, who am I? Well, I'm me. No, this is me. This is my body. That's who I am. I'm not you and I'm not you. I'm not the table. I'm not the fan. I am me, my body. My body defines who I am. Makes sense. But we all know, we've read it someplace, that all of the cells of our body are replaced in the course of a lifetime. Right? There's nothing here that came out of my mother's womb. And there's very little here, no pun intended, I meant H-E-R-E, there's very little here that will be around when I meet my maker, be a different body to a large degree. And not only a different body, but to a large degree, the hopes and the aspirations and the plans I had when I was 10, I no longer hold. And those that I had when I was 20, I will a large degree have abandoned by the time I'm 80, if I make it that long. And if I have a different body now, I do, and if I have different plans and aspirations and goals, then in what sense am I the same person? I had a professor in college that said that in today's world in which our plans and hopes and aspirations change so quickly, it makes no sense for a 20-year-old to save for retirement because he's a different person by the time he gets to retirement. But it's a legitimate philosophical question, although it has answers, of what makes me the same me from the age of 20 to the age of 40 to the age of 60 to the age of 80? Why do I call it the same person? If it's a different body and different aspirations and plans and goals, what gives the continuity to this person? In other words, what is the definition of personal identity? Again, there are answers to that question, but I bring up the question because it's important to see that it's not 100% clear what actually creates personal identity. And if you're willing to follow me on this mind exercise of thinking about what creates identity, well, just like I can legitimately ask what makes the Hanan of 30 years ago the same Hanan as 30 years from today, just like I can ask myself, perhaps my personal identity should be limited to just one day, and then the second day is a different person, or a different year, a different decade. Just like I can talk about limiting personal identity, I can also talk about expanding personal identity. My son has my DNA. He also has my plans and hopes and aspirations, to a certain degree, my ideology. Some of the very same experiences. If I'm willing to say that the me of 2008 2009, is the same Hanan of 2020, then it's not that much of a jump to say that my son is that same personality. Again, same DNA as me, with some additions, and a lot of the same plans and hopes. It might even be that our children carry with them more of the hopes and aspirations that we had when raising them than we ourselves have when we reach retirement. You heard what I said? Sometimes they're more we than we are. They retain those childhood things we taught them more than we retain as we grow older and mature and retire. So there's certainly a basis to say that personal identity doesn't have to end with my body, but rather my son, my daughter, perhaps my grandchild, is just as much or almost as much me as I am me. It's almost arbitrary to put the boundary of personal identity with my body. Perhaps it extends to my children, to my children's children. Perhaps it goes back to my parents and my forefathers. So the point I'm trying to make, I'll just finish the thought, is that we moderns, for reasons that have a basis, put the boundaries of personal identity from birth to death. But it's not so simple. You can certainly make a case, especially in a society in which families live together and work together and develop together, you can certainly make a case for expanding personal identity to earlier and later generations. That in some sense, my parents and myself and my children are the same corporate personality. And the minute we are willing to entertain that possibility, now we start to understand what is the basis of this idea of zchut avot. You don't have to accept the idea, even if you accept expanded identity, but you begin to see where it's coming from. Because if we're all part of one group, and it's especially true when we live in an agrarian society that's based on a close knit family and clan, you can see how my father and my grandfather and my grandmother and great-great-great-grandmother are somehow tied into the same personality, same legal corporate personality as my grandchildren and further down the line. And then, if I accept that I can get credit for things I did 5 years ago, well, why can't I get credit for the things I did 500 years ago? And of course, the other side of the coin is also true. If I'm to be punished for a crime I committed at the age of 20 and I'm still in jail at the age of 60, then why can't I be punished for a crime I committed 200 years ago or 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago? But we're talking more about the reward than the punishment. So the idea is that if Abraham did something unbelievably powerful to show his loyalty to God, that the reward for that can continue throughout his life, and we are his life. We are him, in a certain sense. Yes?
You could take, if it's the punishment, you could say that's what they're saying. What they used, Christians used to say about the Jews, that we had to suffer for the death of Jesus.
Right, right.
I don't buy that. I mean, I think each generation is the sum of new experiences, different lifestyles, different, you know, especially now. Maybe 5,000 years ago, it wasn't as fast-paced as
right.
It is today.
Right. Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
And I don't agree that we should punished for the sin of killing a Jesus.
Well, I don't either.
But I mean...
Yeah, I really understand. Let me point out, we talked in the previous class for those who were there about the Code of Hammurabi and contemporaneous laws of those of the Torah. We see in the Code of Hammurabi an identity, a complete identity between the generations. In other words, parents can literally be punished for the sins of their children,
in court, and vice versa, children for the sons of the, for the sins of the parents. Even as far as the death penalty, and as far as other punishments of amputation in the Code of Hammurabi. The Torah seems to struggle with the limits of corporate personality. Right, there are places in which the Torah says, right, the Jewish law says, I'm sorry, the Bible says, that children should not be punished for the sins of the parents. Should not be. In other words, the Bible works with a framework of corporate identity, of expanded identity throughout the generations, and struggles where its limits are. Certainly, there's something perverse when corporate personality goes too far, and I don't know to define what too far means. In the past, I don't know how to say this, 300 years, 200 years, as the modern world has developed, the Enlightenment, the Western world has moved away from corporate identity to individual identity. And it goes without saying that there's tremendous advantages to personal identity and personal responsibility. And I would say that at this juncture, as Jews, we should be struggling with the definition of identity. There's something very important in personal identity, but there's something very dangerous in completely leaving behind corporate identity. When you completely leave behind corporate identity, you end up as a molecule floating in a sea that is completely unconnected to who you are and what you stand for. We have to, I think all of us, navigate a compromise between these two types of identities. I really think it's one of the central elements of being a Jew in the modern world, is navigating this question. I always talk about this on Pesach. Pesach tries to teach us to develop a larger sense of self. So anyway, that's the idea of Zechut Avot, and that's what's going on in the many places in literature in which we invoke this idea of Zechut Avot because of the, on the basis of the Akedah. Yeah. Barbara.
Why is it that maybe the lesson learned from this, besides saying that Abraham followed God's orders and you should too, but that God doesn't want you to kill your children, why isn't that equally as important, especially since, if I'm correct, at the time that Abraham lived, it was common practice for pagans to make child sacrifices.
Right.
So why isn't that just as important a lesson?
Perhaps it is. It's been mentioned that Rav Kook says that we learn for all generations from this story that child sacrifice is not what God wants. And you're right, that's certainly a part of it. But again, that doesn't, that should not prevent us from looking at the pain of the process that everyone went through and asking ourselves what the meaning of that is, as we saw in Rabbi Soloveitchik. So, at the end, we could look at one commentary that tries to say that Avram did not pass the test. On page 156, what this commentary basically says on page 156 is that God was testing Avraham to see if Avraham had completely distanced himself, this ties into what Barbara said, distance himself from the paganism that was around him, the paganism that included child sacrifice. And it says that Avram failed the test. This commentary was written by a contemporary scholar, Matthew Mosinkis, who I never met, never heard of. Just look at the last three words on page 156. This text implies that Avram was checked at the border crossing into monotheism to see whether a remnant of paganism from his Holtz culture had not entered into his bag under the guise of a leap of faith. And look at the last sentence at the top of 157. It may thus be inferred that in a sense Avram failed the test. That's what this particular commentator writes. But I have to be honest with you. It seems to me wishful thinking, because you open up our text, it says twice that God said to Abraham, how great you are for not withholding your son. And we can try and, you know, get around it and look at different ways of interpreting. You can read further in the booklet. There's lots of very, very ingenious efforts to get around what the Torah says. But it seems to me that we should accept the text for what it says and then try and grapple with it, not to try and read into it what it doesn't say. So, go home and look at it. I just want to say one more thing, which is, there's a commentary here by Professor John Levinson from Brandeis, and it's on page 171. I recommend that you look at it at home, page 171. He basically says, John Levinson's alive today, he's still a rather young man, he's in his 40s I think. He says that all the modern efforts to reread the Akedah, as if Avram failed the test, they seem to be unable to accept a basic element of biblical religion, which is the idea of sacrifice.
Yeah.
That to be willing to sacrifice for God, sacrifice in the sense of to give up, to recoil, to surrender to God, as a positive value in biblical religion, it's hard for us to accept. And you know what? It's hard for me to accept. I understand it's hard to accept. But I do think that it seems that the Torah is trying to tell us, as Rabbi Soloveitchik so poignantly explained, so eloquently explained, that the idea of being willing to sacrifice, to give up, to surrender, for no reason, just because there is an authority over you, that apparently is a central moment in biblical religion. And perhaps there's something to be learned from it.
That's why we've lasted 5,000 years. Our Jewish identity, we've lasted 4,000 years.
Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's an idea, it's a concept that is difficult from many most modern sensibilities.
Of course.
It
like I said, for me also.
In our modern sensibility. So we look for ways to
reinterpret it.
Reinterpret it. Say, it doesn't really mean that.